So good afternoon, everybody. It's nice to see you again. So just to say, my piece, I've been asked to speak for about 40 minutes or so, and then after we can chat amongst ourselves and questions and kick things back and forth. But don't worry, that's not keeping you from your dinner, as it doesn't start till 6:15. So don't think, God, would he stop? I'm starving. Dinner's at 6:15, so whatever we do here, that's the time. So just in the back of your mind, know that I'm not keeping you from your dinner. The other thing, just to say, the beginning of the presentation is something similar to what I did here a little while ago when I was with you. So the beginning is a little bit similar, but don't think, oh God, it's the same talk. It's not. It's just teeing an idea up, but going somewhere else with it. So just when you see it, you think, oh God, I saw that before. It's just the same kind of idea, but going in a different direction with it. So let me say something about the title, Catholic Schools Matter. Catholic Schools Matter because I just thought, quite simply, because God matters. Like, at a very fundamental level, the reason there are Catholic schools in Ireland or all over the world is because people believe in God. There's really no other reason, that there's a sense of this reality called God. And that has to be one of the fundamental core planks of Catholic schools, just very fundamentally. That's a contested idea, and we'll talk about it now. And in Ireland today, it's contested. But from a Catholic views point of view, it's just if there's no God, there's no need for Catholic schools. But how we think of God is the key thing, I suppose. What I want to do is present three ideas about God, that God is present, purposeful, and personal. You'll notice the alliteration. I worked very hard on that. But there are three ideas within the Christian tradition about God. And I want to kind of tee these up and wonder about those in light of our own experience, because it's our own experience of God is going to matter when it comes to our schools, because our interpretation of this word is essential, it's core. How we come to know what this word means for ourselves is what we'll translate into our schools, because as Parker Palmer always says, we teach who we are. We'll all teach the subjects differently because we're all different, but we'll teach to the curriculum, but we teach out of who we are. And that's the key. So let's begin with ourselves. So first things first, will you think a bit about that word? What does it conjure up for you? What do you notice yourself feeling or remembering or thinking about or seeing? What does that word conjure up for you? And then I'm going to ask you to say a little word about that to the person beside you, so that we begin to think about our own experience of this word. What's my understanding, experience, appreciation of what that word points to? Will you turn to the person beside you? Don't know them, say hello, introduce yourself, and have a chat about what does that mean? Okay, folks. Let me invite you back. We'll get a chance to talk some more later on. But let me invite you back in the meantime. Thanks for doing that. It's hard to stop you off and invite you back, but we'll have a chance to talk some more as time goes on. So let me invite you back. So I think one of the most popular ways that people think about God is often that God is genuinely a man up here. That when we think of God, often people think a man, and generally at a distance. I was at an event recently, and they had school children singing Nancy Griffith's song, God is Watching Us from a Distance. It was beautiful, the harmonizing. But the idea, I'm not too sure about, that God is watching us from a distance. Beautifully performed, oh my goodness. But I wonder about the lyrics, and I'll tell you why as we go on. But I think most people think that God is here, God is a man often, and we're here and we pray to God out here somewhere because something's on our mind and we maybe get an answer back from God and we're changed. Oh my goodness, we managed to get the bouncy castle for the communion or something. And just, oh God, the relief, pure relief. Are we here? We shoot off a prayer to God and somebody is sick belonging to us and well, nothing comes back from God. And the person just gets sicker and sicker, and sicker, and there seems to be no answer from God. Other times we believe we shoot something off and God seems to shoot something back to us. But the point here is that the emphasis on the distance between us and God, that God is out there somewhere. I suppose that's the important piece. And that God is another individual. Literally, God's a man. God's out there, this person, just bigger, better, and more powerful than anybody else you know. Just more loving, more compassionate, more forgiving than anybody else you know. So God is this person out there somewhere. But I think that's kind of problematic, because God then is literally we think, a being out there somewhere. God's a thing within creation. Now that'll become clear in a minute. So that God is another thing. There's this room, these chairs, there's people, and then there's God out there, this thing in creation. And that God is competing, this thing's competing for my attention. You know, Justin, Sister Annette, and Kathleen compete for your attention. So they want you here. You go, oh my God, can I make that date and work at school and minding kids and coming out? People compete for our attention all the time. And we can think that God is competing for our attention. Go to Mass on Sunday or say a prayer at night. On top of everything else we're doing, we've got to talk to God along with our children and our staff and our own families. And then there's God on top of that. And that God then is to be found in holy places. You know, we think we go to a church and say a prayer, or a holy well, or climb the Reek, or go to Lourdes. That this sacred person is accessed through sacred places. But a man in Boston College who taught me there is Rick Gilardi, is his name. Folks, you're welcome. Is Richard Gilardi, and he says, I think it's better to think of it like this. So he puts the world there, and then he puts a G there and a D there. And he says that really, God isn't outside the world. The world is inside God. So that's a very different kind of perspective. And that everything in the world can reveal God. Everything in the world can reveal God because God is present everywhere in the world. So notice he's getting away from the idea of God as a man. And then he quotes from Acts, after Luke's gospel, in God we live and move and have our being. In God we live and move and have our being. Not with God out there, in God. So that's an important shift. And you see then, everything is within the reality we call God. Everything. So the universe is within. So when we think then about the universe, there's 7 billion people or so on our teensy, teensy part of the universe, 8.7 million species of animals, 10 quintillion insects. That's a lot of insects, like when you think about it. Like, and then 10,000 million stars. It's enormous. It's hard to even imagine. And then you see, we think that, oh, there's God right there, just in the middle of all this. And then God talks to us from within the universe. That's the original idea. But Gilardi says, no, that's not God. It's not God. God is not another being, along with all the other beings, us human beings, chairs, tables, the floor, all these buildings. God isn't another thing in the universe. Rather, God is being. So you're going to earn your dinner now tonight for this. God is being. And we're not going to spend much on that philosophy thing. But God is the source or the condition for us living in the first place, as opposed to another thing in creation. And the universe is dependent on God. So Gilardi then, taking his view, he'd shrink all this down, and he puts a G there and a D there. That everything is within what we refer to as God. But the problem is we've made God so small. We've made God into this man out there who kind of is very loving and lovely, generally white, which is interesting, elderly, well-fed, but at a distance. There are certain characteristics we give to this, what we call or think God. But everything is within God. Everything. So Nemo, the movie Nemo, if you've got children, you've probably seen Nemo, our teaching. See, the ocean or the water is the unseen condition for Nemo's life. So Nemo's not aware of being soaking wet. He doesn't wake up in the morning and say, oh, Daddy, I'm soaking, like I'm so wet. He's just wet all the time. If he wasn't wet, he couldn't live. But he's not aware of the wetness, just as we're not aware of God most of the time. But Christians make the claim that God, G-O-D, is the unseen condition for our existence, just as we're not aware of the air in this room until it gets a bit stuffy and you're getting tired, then you start getting aware of the air in the room. We're not aware of it. So Nemo and all the life in the ocean is utterly dependent on water. We're utterly dependent on air, but we rarely are aware of it until it gets stuffy or it's very cold or whatever. The point is, we're not aware of it, but because we're not aware of it, doesn't mean it's not there. Or somebody once said, the absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. I have to work that one out. Okay. So what I want to say is, one, God is present. In the Christian tradition, God is present everywhere with all of us at all times. The difficulty is that we're just often not aware of it. We're just so busy teaching kids and writing to the department and minding our own children at home or going out playing a bit of football or something or playing. We're just not aware of it. But God is present all the time. That's the first claim in the tradition. Let me just pause. I'm not going to ask you to talk about it. But just pause for a minute. When you think of that thing of presence, the claim is that God is present. Is that your own experience? Would you have a sense, I have a sense of God's presence, or very little, or whatever. Just think about it for a second. And then you got to think about what's the quality of that presence. When I was small, I remember stealing some money from my sisters, my twin sisters older than me, I was about maybe 7 or so. And I stole some money from their bedrooms. And I lived in Dundalk, went up the town and bought a record. In those days, we bought records. And bought a record with the stolen money. And I was coming home on the bike. And the chain came off the bike. That's okay. We was kind of down out of Dundalk. So I was kind of freewheeling on the bike, put my foot in the pedal and kind of just pushed myself along. So I was just whizzing home, that was okay. And then I got a puncture in the back wheel. I said, oh God. So I was just walking, but it was kind of close enough. And then the heavens opened, and began to pour. And I really thought, that's kind of God getting me for stealing the money. That's God's way of saying. And that, you see this thing of, what's your experience of God? And as a 7-year-old, I was thinking that God is there waiting. I do something wrong, but God will wait in the long grass. And that you'll get at some stage. It mightn't be immediate, but God will get you. God will trip you up at some stage. That's how I thought of who and what God is. So there's a thing of experience, but what's the quality of the experience? And that's important to wonder about. So let's talk about that. So God is present. That's a claim in this tradition. But God's also purposeful. You see, there's a presence of electricity in this room. It's not terribly purposeful. It's conducted in certain ways, but of itself, it's not purposeful. It's just raw energy. Is God just raw energy? A lot of young people say God's like a force. But is the force, what kind of energy is it? And the claim is that this God is purposeful. So another lecturer in Boston College, Michael Himes, he asked this question. What's the least worst way to describe God? It's really peculiar. If you're teaching English to kids, you've got to write better than that. What's the least worst way to describe God? And for him, you see, he's saying whatever way, whatever word or analogy you use to describe God, it's always going to fall short. It'll never capture in words or music or drawings or symbols the reality of God. But he says if I had to pick one word, he says I'd pick this, agape, God is love. To be found in the first letter of St. John, chapter 4, verse 8, verse 16, where it says that God is love. Now, there's all kinds of loves. There's romantic love. Mother's Day is coming shortly, so there's a love for your mother. And there's brotherly love, philia coming from the Greek, Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. Eros, more erotic, sexual kind of love, physical kind of intimate love. And then there's agape. And agape is the kind of love that is simply concerned about the well-being of the other. So with your children, in your own schools, some kid just might drive you bananas. Oh my gosh, just gets on your nerves, just always has. But you want her to do well, irrespective of her, of the feelings she conjures up in you. Oh my God, you see her, and then her mother's coming with her, oh God. And you're trying to dodge, oh, the senior, okay. And then you're over to them. But you've made a commitment to yourself, irrespective of their feelings, you really work very hard with her and with her family so that she can thrive. See, that's agape. There's nothing in it for you per se. See, with romantic love, there's a little bit of payoff. If I'm in love with somebody, it's lovely being loved. My brothers, my sisters, my family, my wife, my children, that's lovely most of the time, you know. But agape is different. It's only concerned with the well-being of the other. So you're concerned with the well-being of your children and the extra yard you go for them. Nobody sees it. It's really troublesome. You're trying to get funding. You're managing stuff in a certain way and you give it, get it, an extra teacher or something, a resource. It's been a huge headache for you. There's no great payback per se. That's agape. You're up all night with a child who's colicky and you're just through walking up and down. The temperature's going through the roof. You're going bananas. You've got to get the lunches and you're tired and you're a bit fluey. That's agape. Because you don't feel great. Like, oh, I'm loving this. Oh, this is so gorgeous with this kid here. It's just boiling. I can't get the temperature. I'm not sleeping at all. Two other kids get up in the morning. No, you don't. That's not a good feeling for you. But you do it. It's agape. It's only about the other. Pope Benedict wrote a book or a short, kind of long letter on this called God is Love. God is love. Now, notice what they're saying is that God is love. Not so much that God is loving. God is love. And he quotes then, when you're even reading documents from the popes, the first few lines are always very important. And he says, very first line in this letter is, God is love. This is important for us. Not that God is loving, but God is the stuff of love. So not a man, he's not saying God is a man. God is love. And he who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. First letter of St. John. Then Benedict says, these words from the first letter of John express with remarkable clarity the heart of the Christian faith. So somebody says to you, what's the heart of the Christian faith? You could say, well, quoting St. Benedict, God is love. So if children ever say to you, what's the Christian faith all about? Or a Muslim, or a Buddhist, or an atheist? You say, well, quoting Benedict, God is love. With remarkable clarity, God is love. And then you see with that, there is nothing that we can do to stop God loving us. For it is the very nature of God to be love. I was at home yesterday. My wife and I have two children, John and James. But the older guy was a bit out of sorts yesterday, John. And I was getting on his nerves. And God, he was getting on my nerves for the day. Just, he couldn't do anything right, God love him. And I couldn't do anything right. And we were just bumping heads. And it was just exhausting for him. But I remember like one stage he was out in the garden and there's kind of a muddy patch beside the grass and he'd started digging a hole in the muddy patch. He's about eight or so, big hole. I said, oh God. So my daughter said, John, don't be digging up the lawn. Like just leave it, you know, the way it is. He said, oh, okay. And kind of, oh, first of all, he said, why? Oh, why can't I dig a big hole on the edge of the grass? I said, just is not the place for holes in the lawn. And he said, well, that's just not fair. I said, oh, just don't do it. So we did side, and then I was peeling spuds for the dinner, and I watched him. When I said to him, on the edge of the grass, it's all got bare. It's just kind of mucky. I said, and just don't walk on the part where it's all bare with the grass. Just don't walk there. I said, okay. So we did side, and I was just peeling spuds, and I could see him. He's with the sword. He's running, and he's running on the bare patch with the grass. And I just told him how to do it, and I'm at the sink. I said, oh, my God. And I throw down the spuds and the thing, and I'm bailing out to him. I said, John, I just told you not to do that. And he said, I can do it if I want. I said, no, you can't, actually. You can't. Well, that's just not fair. Why can't I? And I said, well, you're not in charge of the grass. You don't cut the lawn. Well, I could. I could do that. I said, oh, God, just keep that up. Just keep that up, you know. And you end up locking horns with them. And I just, you want to give me a root and just bug off. So anyway, he went off in a huff, and I went off in a huff, and I'm back in peeling the spuds and stuff like that. And you see, I wasn't loving him. I love him more than anything. Like, he and James, my other son, and my wife family, like, I love them. Like, of the people I love, that's where the most of my love goes. But you see, in that moment, he's stronger than me. In that moment, because I just don't have the patience for him. And I told him not to do it, and he's stronger than I am. My love wasn't withstanding. Whereas if I was in good form, and just everything right, and I wasn't under pressure with dinner, I'd be out and say, John, do you remember I said, don't do that, good man. And he'd say, oh, okay, Daddy. But because I approach him, for God's sake, John, I told you not to do that. He's like, and then he starts getting all, and I start getting worse, and you get locked. Whereas if I came out benignly, I said, John, what's going on? I asked you not to do it, you know? But I didn't. And in that moment, he's stronger because I get stuck. I get caught. So this thing that God is love, see, God never gets stuck or caught the way I did. Now, I love my son, but I get stuck and I get caught because my love isn't strong enough to withstand the irritation at times they give me. That's totally my stuff, not theirs. That's my own lack of stuff inside, and they evoke things in me. But and the problem is we think God's like a loving parent, but parents have limits. We all do. We all get tired and we're grumpy, and our kids in class, and we just, oh God, you know, we just have moments. The claim in this tradition is God doesn't have those kind of moments, for God is love. And if we could give God those moments of getting God really irritated with Dan O'Connor, God, I'm just really cross with you, Dan, I'm going to wait in the long, I'm going to sort you out. I'm stronger than God then, just as my son John is stronger than me going up and down the lawn. He's stronger than me because I don't have the patience for him. But the claim in the tradition is that we will never upset God like that. That we will never, because if we could, then we're stronger than God, and God isn't God. That there's nothing you could do or say that would get you out from under the love of God. And that love comes effortlessly, as opposed to, oh, it's a big effort, because to love John, say in those moments, that's a big effort. I've got to really make an effort. The claim, again, whatever you think of it, the claim in the tradition is that God is love. It's God's very nature to love. See, our natures aren't like that. We love at times. Other times, I'm selfish and I'm mean and I'm small-minded. The claim is in the tradition, there isn't that within what we call God. For God is agape, only concerned about the well-being of the other. So in God, we live and move and have our being. So you could easily change this then and put it like this. Put an L there, O-V-E, that we are in love. The world is in love and held by love. And that our children are in love and held by love. In God, we live and move and have our being. Wouldn't it be lovely if children knew something of that in their heads, but in their hearts, that they are loved effortlessly and unconditionally somewhere deep down, that they would know that. So this presence is purposeful and it loves effortlessly, because sometimes our love is a big effort and we really have to suck it up. Let me ask you, is this your experience of the reality we call God that we say is present everywhere? So just for a minute, I just want to leave kind of silence for you to wonder a bit about that in your own life and experience. And then in the tradition, I've said something about it's present, it's personal, or it's purposeful, but it's also personal. So the claim in this tradition is that this God who is love reaches out towards us. So Michelangelo's painting of God reaching out towards Adam. And the thing here is there's a real deliberateness in the reach, whereas Adam is somewhat indifferent. Yeah, whatever. But God is really, there's a purposefulness in God's reaching out. Because God wants to make contact with people, wants there to be a personal relationship with people. That's a core claim in this tradition. And then we say, well, where do we notice this personal effect of God? Well, fundamentally in love, where we experience love, where we know love, we can experience God. For God is love. And if that's true, then where we know love, we already know God. Or in beauty, in nature, just when you're walking outside and you see the daffodils coming through and you go, oh, God, look at those. And there's a certain sense, whoa, it's beautiful. In the experience of beauty, and you're kind of, wow, experience of God. Experience of friendship, your friends, people who help us to be ourselves, who we laugh and go out with and have fun with and just build us up. Experience of God. Experience of Eucharist, going to Mass and people saying the body of Christ is a way of God reaching out towards us and making God's self known to us in bread and wine, in the community, in the word, in the priest, just even a church. It's a holy place. And that somehow by going into a church, it can help turn people's attention to the presence of a God who's reaching out, always reaching out to come close and into a personal relationship with people. Or maybe through prayer, just the experience of praying. When you pray or you ask children to pray, that they come to know in the quietness of their own hearts something of God's reach and God's embrace and God's closeness. But ultimately, in the Christian tradition, it's through the person of Jesus Christ that people come to know something of God. Because in the Christian tradition, Jesus is the face of God. And Jesus is God's, if you like, outreach, reaching into humanity to touch us, to help us. So this reaching out of God, revealing this God who is love, I suppose begs the question. You might say, well, I think that's true for other people, but is it true for me? Does God reach out for me? I think God reaches out for other people because I can see why, because they're lovely. But will God really reach out for me? That's a good question for us to wonder about. And you see, the point is in the life of Jesus, Jesus is always reaching out, always, especially to those who are most marginalized. And so we're working with children. We want to tell kids about stories from the Bible, tell them about Jesus, and tell them some of the tradition, that how people have made sense of Jesus, their whole lives. So they know the Jesus of history, but also the Christ of faith, that here's this historical person years ago, but this person's alive today. The priest says the body of Christ, that Christ is alive today. And we tell kids that. And why the incarnation? Why did Jesus come into the world? Well, Ron Rahlheiser tells a story of a little girl who woke up one night with nightmares. She was about 7 years old. She ran into her parents' bedroom and said, Mommy, I'm having terrible nightmares. And her mom just takes her into her bed, just puts her beside her, and she talks all the nightmare out because she's wide awake, and she just tells her all about the nightmare and stuff that's happening. And then after a while, the mom says, come on, I'll put you back to bed. And she says, okay. So she brings her back to her bedroom, and she tucks her into her bed, and she closes the wardrobe and does everything. And then she tucks her in and says, now you're okay. Your dad and myself are just down the corridor. And if you need us, that's where we are. And you know, God's here as well. God's here with you. And she says, I know God's here, but I wish God had some skin. I wish God had some skin. Point being, I wish God was more physical because she can touch her mom and dad. And I suppose that's the point of the incarnation, that it helps us see God. And the incarnation is about the face of God, who is Jesus Christ. And coming to know Jesus historically, but also the Christ of faith, helps us know who and what God is. So God is present, God is purposeful, but also God is personal. That's the claim in the tradition, that God is personal. And we've got to wonder about that for ourselves. So when it comes to a Catholic school, we want children to know about God. So there's stuff they ought to know about God in the Christian tradition. That's kind of just good information. But it's more than that, really, that the children would also know God. And that's quite different. And they need each other. But so Educate Together will do the first. Community National Schools will do the first. But Catholic schools, Protestant schools will hopefully do both. That they'll offer an opportunity for children to know God. But you see, the problem is, I think it's difficult to believe in God today in the world, because if you talk to kids, just suffering. Lots of people suffer in the world today. Just people can be in, children can be in families where there's trouble at home with the parents separating, or pressure with mortgages, or they look at the news in Syria or whatever's going on. They say, well, and you're saying God is love? How on earth is God is love and that's happening? That's ridiculous. So that makes it hard to believe. It's a good question. Or the association of Catholic Church with abuse and neglect. You know the tomb baby thing now? And you say, oh, God. And then if God is synonymous with the church and the church is discredited, well, the whole God thing's discredited. So people kind of say, I don't believe in God. I'm spiritual, just not religious. Or it's just embarrassing to say you believe in God. Like I teach in Mary I, and students, like they don't get out their phones and post up on Facebook, was at Mass on Sunday, it was class. See how many likes you get for that. Just, you know, and yet, actually, loads of them will go to Mass. We did an anonymous survey with the first years with clickers. Like, loads believe in God. Loads believe in God. Loads go to Mass. But they'd be embarrassed to tell anybody. We did it once. I asked them to do kind of a guesstimate. So this group of 100 first years. And I said, so the next question coming up was, how often would you go to Mass? Like, what is it, every day, once a week, once a month, once a year, or never, or something. I said, guess. Put down a guesstimate of what you think your year would do. And in that year, something like 75% went to Mass weekly. And they were kind of, what? They were just really, I never thought that. But the problem is the assumption you make about somebody, I think, if I'm thinking, well, nobody here goes to Mass, really, I'm not going to tell them I go to Mass. And yet 75% of them went to Mass. But they all thought everybody else would think they're ridiculous for going to Mass. So then they didn't say it. Because culturally it's embarrassing, I think. So it's hard to kind of talk about faith. And then is it intellectually credible, believing in God? Or you know, what Richard Dawkins talks about, you know, the spaghetti monster and all that kind of stuff. You know, is it true, really? And if you're scientifically literate, you definitely couldn't believe in God. So these are kind of things I think make it difficult to believe in God. There are some, there's loads, but these are just some. But I think the Catholic school, given that the context, is a place where this belief, it's easy to hold. That it's kind of easy. That's just, there's an openness to believing in God in the Catholic school. It's not embarrassing. It's not this thing is ridiculous and you've got to suspend your critical faculties. That there's a culture in the school where to believe in God is fine. To not believe in God is equally fine amongst the children. There's an openness here around this stuff. But to believe is easier than in the public at large, because I think it's becoming more and more difficult in the public at large. But the Catholic school would be a place where, yeah, I can talk about this stuff without being embarrassed. How? I think the witness of staff is key. I think especially the principal. That if the principal is somebody who can talk about faith or belief in God, it sets a certain standard in the school. A friend of mine teaches in a school, and she was saying Catholic Schools Week was coming along, and they're in the staff room, and the principal turned around and said, okay, guys, you know Catholic Schools Week is here. This is the website. You know, do what you can. That was the extent of it. And that principal just wasn't terribly comfortable with any of this stuff themselves. And there was no witness from the principal around matters of faith. And then there's a certain culture that comes into the staff room where it's a little bit snigger, because there was a little bit of a little round of applause then when he'd spoken like that. So there's a certain tone that can inhabit a staff room around matters of faith, our religion, our ethos, and that can build up over time. Very hard to shift, as I'm sure you know. But the witness is important, your witness. Again, you see, I think it's so true. We teach who we are, and what we think about this stuff can't not but come through to the children. Just it's impossible. We can teach fantastic, but our own beliefs can't not but seep through. Kids will know something about this stuff. So we've got to think, well, what do I think about this stuff for myself? I think the environment is important. What children see around them in the schools around faith. So like when it comes to like the Nativity play, you know, like that's a great event that the Nativity play is about there. And you're telling the story of Christmas. You're telling the story of the incarnation. You're telling the story of God becoming a person. To do what? To affirm the goodness of creation, to affirm the dignity of everybody. What's the purpose of the incarnation? So very small, we start telling the story. So everybody knows the story of the incarnation. And it opens up a conversation about its meaning. Or then you can do a whole lot of integration across the curriculum with that story about refugees, where Jesus had to kind of be brought into Egypt because it wasn't safe to go home. You do stuff on refugees. You do stuff on geography. You do stuff on history. So this is important. I think like stuff like this, like in the school, I was in a school a while ago, and the teacher was just putting this up for Lent. So there was a refreshment of a public display. You can go to schools, and I go to lots of schools through teacher practice and stuff, and oh my God, you could run your finger along the dust on some things that have been there for years. And then you see the kids don't see them anymore. They're just, because they've been there so long, kids just don't see them. Nobody sees them. Or they can be fresh. And then you see children come along, they come down the stairs, there's a whole big stair, they come down the stairs and they just see that. And there's something about, in the school, we think it's okay to believe in this stuff. The hidden curriculum. You see, kids pick up messages all the time. And if you can publicly display, without going overboard, saying this is Lent, and let's think a bit about it. Or as the, you know, Sister Annette and Kathleen have put something together here, that there's a public visibility, and that's okay. I think RE being done well is important. I was in a student was out in a classroom, and she came back and said, the RE teacher was great. She was teaching a second class, and she said she was doing a thing on Jesus, and she was role-playing Jesus. And the kids were asking her loads of questions about Jesus coming to the crucifixion. And said, what was it like? And were you afraid? And what were the nails like when they went in? Were they really, really sore? Like, and who was there? And all that kind of stuff. And how did it feel when you died? And things like that. And they just asked her loads and loads of questions. And then a little guy said, just put up his hand. And she said, yeah. And he asked, do you love me? Do you love me? And it was really interesting. Switching from the knowing about to knowing, and that formation piece. So there's an intellectual piece, very important, but there's also a kind of a formation or transformation piece. Do you love me? I thought it was really interesting in the role, the power of role play, and the kids, do you love me? So it's that balance, but the formation piece and the intellectual piece and the learning, the whole piece of learning. It was interesting, RE, my wife and I were in the local school and having a parent-teacher meeting with the teacher, little guys in second class. And lovely, really, really good teacher. And she was giving us a list. She'd done up a sheet with all the subjects on it. And she was going through the sheet with us, you know, and saying, you know, the English, the writing, needs to watch the writing. I said, okay, and the maths, and watch this, and keep an eye on geography, this. And went through all the subjects. It was great and very thorough. And I just said at the end, how's it getting on at RE? Because there was 11 columns. But there's no RE. And she teaches RE every day. And she's the community. She's fantastic. She's really, really good. So it's not as if she doesn't do it. And she said, we love the Grow and Love program. Because I was involved in writing it, you see. She said, oh, we love the Grow and Love program. I said, I'm not looking for compliments. You know, it's kind of got a bit awkward. I said, no, I'm just wondering how John's getting on. He said, oh, he's great, you know. He's really, really good. And he's very good at the meditative piece at the beginning. It's very easy just to go into himself and just kind of, you know, be present and all that kind of stuff. And he can really do that. So she knew exactly. And later on, I was curious as to why we weren't getting feedback as parents, you know, on that. Like, she was spending a half hour every day, 2.5 hours. She gave us feedback in SPHE, a half hour, but didn't offer feedback until we asked for it. And then she gave us loads. And a few days later, I said to her, you know, I was curious, just how come that, what is that part of the school policy that you just don't give feedback to parents in RE? She said, no. And she had thought about it. She said, I didn't give it because it's not really an assessable, it's a different kind of subject and you don't really assess it. I didn't want to get into it with her, but I don't know about that. I think there's kids, stuff you do assess. There are certain things ought to be known by children when they go through RE, and the parents ought to be told, how's their child doing in RE? I appreciate it's a different kind of subject, but the bit of research that's done, the kids seem to really like RE. Enjoy it as a subject, but I was caught that we don't get the feedback on it, and I'm wondering then, is that kind of a creeping kind of invisibility about Catholic ethos? We don't talk about RE, and just the whole thing of Catholic schools, and we end up kind of putting everything down because we don't want to cause offense to anybody. Or is it just about the hassle of talking to parents about RE? Oh, do you teach RE? What exactly do you in RE here? And oh my God, it's just opening a minefield for yourself. But not doing it, I don't know. But you're at the coalface, I'm not. But I think the thing of RE then provides a chance to pray with children. Like loads of schools do mindfulness now, which is lovely, and it's fantastic to help kids just become attuned to themselves, to become present to themselves and the world around them. And then in an RE class, it's very easy to bring that a step further into kind of Christian meditation, where people can, in a mindful state, then try and become aware of this thing of God is love. Where do I notice this presence of God who is everywhere. So mindfulness is fantastic and provides a great foundation for Christian meditation then, which is the religious end of it, if you like. And then prayer. Yeah, I've said a word about prayer. You see, the Catholic school is an academic environment. It's here you're going to learn and think and reflect. And I think then it behoves a Catholic school to kind of think about faith in a reasonable way, that there's a credibility to this, as opposed to you've got to suspend your critical faculties to believe in God. And so, like, you could point to people. Here's William Campbell. He won the Nobel Prize in, I think I've clicked something there by accident. Don't have to get rid of that. Sorry. Justin, you don't have to get rid of that? Or by... Anyway. Oh, there it's gone. Okay. There. So he won the Nobel Prize for Medicine 2 years ago from Donegal, and he believes in God. So, like, it's important, I think, that children see people who are, like, really intelligent, and they believe in God. He's a scientist, and he believes in God. That these things aren't mutually exclusive, necessarily. There's loads of scientists who don't believe in God, but there's loads of scientists who do believe in God and don't see it as an either-or subject. Or a point of figure like Lady Gaga. There she is with the priest after Ash Wednesday, believing in God. That there are cultural figures who believe in God. So that you're validating their own experience of, I kind of believe in God, but I'd be so embarrassed I wouldn't tell anybody. But there's kind of Lady Gaga believes in God. Our previous presidents believe in God and practice their faith. Mickey Hart believes in God and practice their faith. Loads of sports people believe in God. And so what you want to try and do, I say, there's a reasonableness to it. That these people aren't all stupid. And somehow, if they only learned more, then they wouldn't believe in God. If they're more intelligent or something. So no, they're very intelligent, hugely committed people, and believing in God makes sense to them. It's credible. Here's Anthony Foley's son. I don't know if you heard about this. You know about the 8 Sundays. So his father, Anthony Foley, played rugby for Munster in Ireland, wore number 8. And his son here, who is 11 years old, said, I'd love if people maybe went to Mass for 8 Sundays leading up to Christmas after he died. And he set up a Facebook page about that. And then loads of people around the world began to go into churches and light candles. So there's a little guy at 11 years old, and faith kind of made sense to him. And it helped him in the most awful circumstances, the sudden death of his father. So again, you're trying to introduce children to the credibility or the reasonableness of this tradition. But I suppose it's about planting seeds as well in a Catholic school that later on they can withstand stuff. And I was struck by, remember the Berkeley tragedy? It was amazing how many people prayed around that, young people. They gathered and they prayed. There were chaplains over there in California at the time, and they used to go to Mass, and they gather, have these memorial services. But it's interesting how much kind of the Christian narrative was a part of it. You know, they reached back maybe for something that they hadn't reached into for a long time, but it was there, perhaps because they were children. I'm only surmising. I don't know this, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case. In a Catholic school, what's proposed, but it's never imposed, and that's important. That in a Catholic school, there's a worldview, and it's proposed to children, to staff about God and how we might live our lives and what makes sense, but it must never be imposed. So there's a profound respect for everybody's views because it's an academic environment where you offer things credibly, and then you wonder about them together, and people say, I don't believe that at all. And you say, well, good for you. Tell me why. What makes more sense to you? What's more trustworthy to you? So that's learning. And they're beginning to get to know themselves better while they're bumping into the Christian tradition. And they might leave the school as an atheist at 12 years old or say, I don't believe in God at all. Good for you. If they thought the thing through for themselves, that they're beginning to get to know themselves and be more themselves, as opposed to pretending to be something they're not. So it's always proposed, never imposed. Okay, so we're finished now. So I'm saying about there's a presence in the Christian church, that God is everywhere, that this presence is personal, and it's also purposeful in that it's love. There's a purposefulness to the presence. The question is about noticing this presence, which isn't always terribly easy. Two questions to you. Do you think it's easy to believe in God in your school? Like, is it kind of easy? Or is it a bit kind of, wouldn't be saying that loud. Like in your staff room, is there a culture in your staff room? Could you easily talk about faith? Or, oh, I came to talk to a nice fella, gave it from Mary I. Or would you say, won't be saying that now. And then the children in your school, is it easy just to believe in God? Second question. Of whatever thing I've said, what makes a bit of sense to you? What doesn't make a bit of sense to you? What's problematic? You say, Dan, I understood what you're saying, but I don't really agree with it, and here's why. So will you think about both those questions? And then I'm going to ask you to turn to the people you're chatting to at the very beginning and maybe have a word about either of those or something else. And then we'll come back and see where we stand with a wider kind of conversation. So will you take a minute and just maybe have a think? Don't talk for a second. Some people need to think themselves into clarity. Other people need to talk themselves into clarity. So let's give the thinkers a minute to think themselves. So don't say a word to anybody for a second. So try not to talk. Okay, talk. I just can't stop you. Okay. Have a chat. Have a chat.
So, to confirm that everybody has signed in.
Okay, let's just do that. Issue. And I'm conscious of a quarter to tea time as well, so that's fine. Yeah, okay, folks, can I invite you back, please? I'm conscious of time and things like that as well. And I know Justin wants to ask you something first, take something for a second. So,
sorry, folks, one question. Is there anybody that didn't sign the attendance register? You're all in. Thank you very much.
Okay.
We'll back to Dan. Thank you.
So I'm conscious of time. We have 10 minutes, or not, as the case may be. You might go before that, but dinner starts in 10 minutes. So just to kind of keep that in mind, sort of the tummies are rumbling. But let me just open the space to the floor if people have a comment or question or reaction to anything that might be good for us to hear or wonder about. And so just to open it up a little bit to yourselves. Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks very much. Great. Please. Okay. I hope he's going to tell that on to the Pope or something, just to pass it on. Yeah. But feel free, if somebody has a kind of a contrarian view, you know, the contrarian is just I'm wondering about something else, please feel free to ask that or push back a little bit and say, Dan, yeah, I appreciate that, but here's a little bit what's on my mind about some of this stuff. Just please feel free, that's the important part. Please.
I'm in a Catholic school, but we have a lot of non-Catholic children.
Yeah.
And the non-Catholic children, or whatever they are, would be far more forceful in what they want for their children, and Catholics would be, if we miss religion for a day, no one would say anything.
Yeah.
But if you taught religion to some of those children, they would be in straight away to knock you for that.
Yeah.
I don't think we're forceful enough then.
Yeah.
I'm not imposing religion on children,
but yeah.
They would have much more stronger views than the Catholic.
Yeah. I think, though, just the problem for us, and a couple of us were chatting at the beginning, we're in kind of a conundrum. We have like 90% of the schools in the state are Catholic patrons, but that's not reflective of the population. So I think you have parents who are kind of Catholic parents who are kind of indifferent about a lot of this stuff, just doesn't really matter to them. I think so that's problematic then. So you've loads of people in a Catholic school, and teachers then do their very best to be inclusive towards everybody, and that there can be a loss sometimes in that. And it's a real balancing act in each school. And until the numbers come down of the schools that we have, like I think everybody says we have too many Catholic schools, then I think we're going to be faced with that all the time. And then you're going to have not just parents, you're going to have teachers. I teach at Mary I, we have 450 students in a year. Not every student's really looking forward to going into a Catholic school. And 90% of them will go into a Catholic school because that's where the job will be. And then you'll have people on staff for whom they're not anti it, they're just, you know, whatever. You know, wouldn't be really intentional and careful about it. Just, you know. So those numbers need to go down a bit. Please.
Is it because it's not a conscious decision? Most parents, I have a parent and I have a child who's making And I spoke to this woman today who decided she would wear a Catholic, her child, because she's not. She's going to celebrate him rather than the religion.
Yeah.
And she's made a conscious decision, like you were saying, to follow on from it. As Catholics, in America, if you have a child going to Catholic school, you have to jump through hoops to get your child into that school.
Yeah.
And they are the best schools. It's the same in the UK.
Yeah.
But I think we take it for granted, and we don't push our agenda because we think that we have, in this country, a right to a Catholic school, and that we will be taught and our children will be reared in a certain way. And it's not a conscious decision. So it's subconsciously that we hand over to the schools and we don't question.
Yeah.
The other children have probably had to fight for their children and their
Yeah.
So that they are more advanced and progressive with their will.
Yeah.
The person in a Catholic who doesn't have to think outside of, will I get my child baptized?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That's the only point where a parent makes a decision for a child.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's
I think they're probably more aggressive. We do. It's subconscious. You don't think about it till baptism.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. That's a cultural issue about how we make meaning and stuff.
But I'd also think too, the reporting in the media at the moment about Catholic schools is like as if, you know, that they are nearly bad.
Oh yeah. Places, yeah.
And that they are exclusive rather than inclusive.
That's right.
And that you know, that they are not welcoming places. And I mean, I've taught in different Catholic schools down through the years, and I would have to say there was always an openness to children of all faiths.
Yeah.
I would hope to think that in my own school that would be the ethos that we, as part of our Catholic ethos, that everybody is welcome and respected. But I think against that backdrop, whereas, you know, you're getting this quite an agenda where it's kind of like, you know, that anything to do with religion is kind of old hat.
Yeah.
You know, we should be striving for kind of a secular society. I think there is a tension there.
Very much so. And even then with the NCCA, with the ERB, Education about Religion, Beliefs and Ethics, that's a piece of that, that needs to be in all schools now. That began in the Forum and Patronage Report with Rory Quinn years ago, John Cullen, and they began there saying, what about children who aren't in RE? And there's a legitimate concern for people just not learning anything for 8 years, if you like. So they said there should be some course, maybe ERB in ethics. But then it grew from the children who weren't doing RE to all the children getting that. But there's no evidence to say there's a problem at the moment in religious education, say. But because it fits with a certain worldview, an ideological worldview, that is very, the media are very receptive to that, you'd really get that impression. So the NCAA are really pushing that one very hard. And even after all the consultancy done, most teachers and people, the NCAA asked, talked to 26 teachers. Out of thousands, talked to 26 teachers. And the most reports, the service came back and said, we're not terribly interested in this curriculum overload. We don't know how this thing is going to work. It's going to be problematic in Catholic schools. And yet the framing of it was, there seems to be a good interest in this subject. It seems extraordinary that even done the consultation, they didn't interpret it that way, you know. So I think there's a strong agenda that's going to look into EAT at Catholic schools. Folks, speaking of EAT, we have 2 minutes to go. So before you go, you had a guy called Tom Groom over here, and Tom taught me at Boston College. He used to say to us at the end of a lecture or something, he'd say, okay, guys, okay. And we go, what is it? And he'd say, come here. And we go, all right. And he said, what did you learn in school today? So let me ask you, you've gone to trouble to come here. You've listened to me and each other a little bit. What did you learn in school today? Like, is there something you'll take with you? You know, you say, yeah, I think that's something I'd take with me from this conversation. It wasn't anything I said, it's something that occurs to you. What will you take with you? So for a minute, I'm going to be quiet. I'm going to ask you just to think about that, and then go and eat. So just for a minute, what will you take with you? What did you learn for yourself in school today? Folks, thanks a million. I hope you have a lovely evening and a lovely dinner. So thank you very much.